Welcome to another legislative podcast with House Majority Leader Brian Cutler, representative for the 100th Legislative District in Lancaster County. I'm your host, Chuck Nichols. Representative Cutler, welcome to another podcast. The first thing we'd like to talk about, Representative, is the state budget address given by the governor earlier this month. He came out with a fairly decent tone. He said some things that people did like, said some things that people didn't like, but also said that there'd be no new taxes, something that almost everyone likes. Talk to us about what you agreed with, what you didn't agree with, and maybe what's up in the air a little bit here.
Well, first of all, I think that it's important to focus on those things where we can agree, because once we find agreement, I think that increases the likelihood that things can progress more quickly. Specifically, the governor did not ask for any new taxes contained in the budget, while he did ask for some other policy items, such as minimum wage increases, teacher salary adjustments, and increased educational funding. The overall tone of the budget and the direction, I think, was a great starting point. Specifically, I think this is important because it aligns with many of the policies that we've been advocating for here in the House and the Senate for the last several years, which really focus on educational opportunities, workforce development, and skills and job training, as well as the idea that government should work. I think that one of the things that frustrates everyone, and myself included, is that oftentimes government seems to not all be pulling in the same direction. And by that, I mean, for example, I have a case back home where there's a constituent, a young couple who are building a home, a small garage with a small workshop detached from it. The gentleman happens to be a metal worker and a welder, and they are $80,000 into permits and engineering fees and other things even before they break ground. And we can't have a serious discussion about affordable housing or workforce development or life opportunities when you have those kinds of expenses before you ever get out of the starting gate. So I think when we look at government, we expect government to work quickly and efficiently. We expect the permits to be turned around quickly. We expect the criteria by which the permits will be judged to be very clear. And sometimes it tends to be a little too subjective. Now, the good news is our regional DEP office is making improvements, but there does continue to be a backlog. So as we work towards that, I think it's important to stay focused on all of us as consumers, individuals who want to put on an addition, expand a business, expand our farm, you know, whatever that particular issue is, we need to be focused on the consumer and the customer, not what does the checklist, if you will, or piece of paper say where we have to always go and then leave a lot up to discretion. And that's really been the frustration that I've heard from individuals, depending on what the process is for the forms and the areas. Sometimes you'll get different answers, and that inconsistency leads to problems when individuals want to build or live here.
And so we know that we stand in agreement with the governor. We need to build a little bit of a better business climate here in the state. We need to be a little bit more flexible, and we need to get working together to get things done. There are some things, though, in the governor's budget address that either, A, didn't add up or didn't seem quite right. And one of the things I'd like to address with you is how it seems that every year we do more and more things, and sometimes the budget numbers stay eerily the same. And this year we're talking about spending more money but not needing more taxes. And how does this work? It seems like we have some shifting around of money that goes on in the budgeting process. Could you explain to us what goes on as far as moving money around and why we're not seeing the entire picture when we talk about the state budget that everyone knows?
When we discuss the state budget, specifically the general appropriations bill or the GA bill, we generally are referring to all the state tax revenues that come in through sales tax, income tax, corporate taxes, and the programs and lines that they will all fund. What is often not discussed are those restricted accounts, which may have an income stream going into them from somewhere else in government, a percentage of the realty transfer tax or a percentage of the sales tax, or any other number of items and issues that could be dedicated to specific expenses. What happens is that spending then occurs, and I'll use the colloquial term, which is it's offline. It's not specifically lined and funded in the budget. So it's offline, and it's still state dollars that were collected from taxpayers being spent, but they don't show up on the actual balance sheet when it comes time to reconcile the budget. More and more throughout the years, these funds are essentially on autopilot. They may have a percentage of revenue going into them that made sense at the time when they originally were set up. Perhaps they need reevaluated. Perhaps they need adjusted, either up or down. But the reality is there needs to be the same level of oversight on all of those accounts as the General Assembly has over the general appropriations or the GA bill currently. Personally, I would like to see what that total spend number is, because while we have approximately $34 billion, and that's billion with a B, dollars spent in the budget, the real expenditures are substantially higher than that because of all of the offline spending. So it's been referred to as offline spending. It's been referred to as shadow budget. It's got a variety of different terms. The reality is we're spending a lot more money than is outlined during the budget process. So I think in order to bring transparency and accountability to that, more of those discussions should continue to occur. And the governor has proposed shifting some of those monies to fund programs that are specific to their underlying departments or causes. For example, he's proposing using some special funds that deal with environmental issues to help fund DEP. One of the concerns that you always have, however, is that any time that you do a transfer like that, the question is how many more years can you do that? And should it be adjusted or otherwise evened out in future years so that it's sustainable? Because this is something that governors of both parties do. They will lower items of the budget that they don't have as a priority, increasing theirs. And then when individuals either in the House or the Senate, or in some cases the actual advocates across the Commonwealth say, well, we need this line restored, you end up hyperinflating the top spend number, which obviously causes sustainability concerns for us as taxpayers.
And it's obviously it's not a nefarious thing that's going on. These are legitimate expenditures on legitimate items that most people have no qualms with. It's just it seems a little bit scary when so much money is being spent and not a whole lot of oversight is being looked at. Another thing we'd like to talk about, Representative, it deals with a call that the governor made, and it asked for an increase in the minimum wage here in Pennsylvania. And there have been a lot of studies that discuss why this is a good or bad idea. There's a lot of people that have said, hey, everyone could use a little bit more money, but there's also the flip side of that that says, hey, a lot of jobs are going to be lost if you increase the bottom end of the wage scale to $15. Talk to us about what Republicans are thinking as an alternative and what might be done instead to jumpstart our economy and moving into our legislative priorities here.
I think it's important when you look at any kind of workforce development or wage discussions, we need to recognize what both sides say. One is, obviously, it'd be nice to have more money in your paycheck. I'm not sure that the government, however, is best situated to set that floor artificially. It's currently 7.25 an hour here in Pennsylvania. It hasn't been changed in many, many years. However, there are very few places that are paying that amount, and I think that's important. I've seen job advertisements at a variety of different places. You know, McDonald's for $10 an hour, Subway for $10 an hour, Amazon for $15. You know, you can see these different jobs that are clearly above the arbitrary minimum that the state has set. Now, there are also many jobs that are closer to $7.25 than they are $15, and I understand that. I'm a believer in that whatever we focus our policies on will be what we get more of. So in the case of wages, I would much rather focus on employment opportunities that are focused on middle-class, family-sustaining jobs. And that's why our workforce development package, which there is a lot of agreement with the governor and the House and the Senate on where we should go, because we need to make sure that we have a very qualified and competent workforce that's available for anybody who wants to do business here in the Commonwealth. So we're focusing on those because those are the areas where I would like to see employment gains, not artificially selected by the government, and more importantly, focus on the trades, focus on the career and technical centers, focus on making sure that students are aware of all the opportunities that are out there in terms of employment. And there's a good bipartisan package of bills that's moving from the Education Committee out onto the House floor for final consideration and vote. Hopefully, we'll be able to get all of them to the Senate so that we can continue this discussion. Now, back to the issues of minimum wage, there is a component of the budget that does rely on increased wage taxes being collected from minimum wage. So that's obviously something, if it doesn't happen, we'll have to account for in the budget process. Of equal concern, and what we hear most often, is in talking to small business owners, they're not in a position to necessarily pay an artificially inflated wage. They will manage labor costs by simply not hiring as many people. The Independent Fiscal Office put out a report, and I think it was in excess of 30,000 people could potentially lose their jobs or jobs that would no longer exist if such an increase occurred. That's something that's important to us, should be important to all of us, because when you look at job history and learning those soft skills, showing up on time, punching a time clock, interacting with customers in whatever capacity, in whatever way that you do, the development of those soft skills are very important. And the number one indicator of whether or not you'll be employed after high school, we saw this in the disability movement when we worked on the I Want to Work 2.0 bill, which increased employment opportunities in state government for individuals with disabilities. Myself and Senator Mensch and Representative Dan Miller from Allegheny County, we worked on this bill. It was signed into law late last session. And the number one indicator of whether or not you would have a job after high school is whether or not you had one while you were in high school. So anything that we do to limit those kinds of employment opportunities should cause us concern, because we're limiting future economic opportunities as well. So I think the solution really is we should move people away from a minimum wage, whatever that is, and we can have those discussions, and I'll certainly talk to the governor from a policy perspective about it. But we should be focused on moving them quickly and very definitively away from that into higher and higher paid jobs. You know, I think back over my own work history, you know, I was earning minimum wage when I started working on a dairy farm. I think it was $3 something an hour. And, you know, by the time I got from there to x-ray school and worked as an x-ray tech making $8 or $9 an hour, and, you know, then advanced and got additional certifications and training on the job training that got me, you know, up to $18, $19, $20 an hour. And, you know, I think that those kinds of career paths is really what we should be focusing on. Not that we're going to stagnate at whatever our first job is, but how do you get somebody into a career path that can quickly and rapidly move them up through the wage scale to where they can be not only self-sufficient, but have a very profitable economic opportunity when it comes time to buy a home, buy a car, raise a family, whatever their particular interests are.
And that ties us into the next thing I'd like to talk about, Representative, and that is education and preparation for the future. It was there was a time not so long ago that you and I can both remember that if you got out of high school, you graduated and you had that high school diploma, that you were prepared for the world of work. You were, you know, most likely you'd had a little bit of employment opportunities. You'd had a little bit of work. You were 18. You had that degree, and you were saying, hey, I can go and I can have a job. A lot of times, if you worked hard, that was a career opportunity. And today, a lot of things require a little bit more education. I think we need to take a solid look at it. What are we trying to get out of high school? What should kids have achieved by that time? What should they be thinking about moving forward? And what can we in state government provide for them as far as tools to help them plan for that post-high school time, where they may be entering the workforce or maybe going to trade school or maybe going to college or maybe becoming a doctor. Who knows? But you have to have a more well-developed plan now than I think you had to do 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, and I'm probably not the best example in some ways for this because I always joke that I was a guidance counselor's worst nightmare because I actually was someone, looking back to when you and I were in high school, I was actually someone who went to trade school first. And I distinctly remember the stigma that was attached to not going to college at that time. And thankfully, that's something that I think's improved over time. But I think that also needs to continue to improve. And while I eventually went to college and eventually went to law school, I took a very non-traditional career path. And I'm very pleased with that. I went from being, you know, working on dairy farm, which I alluded to a little earlier, to working as an x-ray tech, to working in radiology administration, and then left there to go to law school and went back to working as an x-ray tech because I had a very employable skill set and a national certification that I could work essentially in any x-ray department, whether it was here or you know anywhere across the Commonwealth. It was a very portable and profitable degree. The best part, and I think this should really be our focus, remember, we have to keep bringing things back to the students who are there today. One, I think that we need to best match the student's career path to whatever their individual interests and abilities are. That's the first thing. And hopefully it's a career path that will set them on a way to making far above minimum wage and having good family-sustaining jobs. And lastly, and this one I think has been lost in the over two decades since I made this decision, too often students who come out have a mountain of debt. And it's not necessarily because of any fault of their own. When you look at the cost of school, it has increased far above the rate of inflation, despite ever-increasing dollars every year going into education after graduation. And the question is why? I think the first point that we need to look at is what's the underlying costs? What are the degrees? What's the likelihood of employability? What's your likelihood that you'd be able to pay back whatever you borrowed? And I think oftentimes, and this was something that I was glad that I had, was as I looked at trade school, I realized, one, that it was very cost effective. Two, it would get me into a career that had upward trajectory and mobility and opportunity. And three, it paid very well. And so when you look at that, I think those should be questions that every student asks themselves. I know those are the questions that I'm going over with my own children as they're looking starting to look at schools. Because it's not enough just to say, I want to be, and then fill in the blank. I think that the next logical question is I want to be, in my case, I wanted to be a lawyer eventually, but what is the most cost-efficient way to get there? Too often, I think we do a disservice to our students because they can't graduate in 4 years. So when you're taking remedial classes from things that you didn't learn in kindergarten through 12th grade that we've already paid for as taxpayers, I think that that remediation delays your graduation. I think that when you get there and there are course issues or struggles or majors are changed, you now go from being a 4 or 4.5 year graduate to a 5 or even a 6. Now you've got 2, 2.5 years or more of extra tuition that's added up. Those are costly changes. And I think all too often we do not give enough information to the families who are making what will really amount to the biggest financial decision that you're likely to make in your life, second probably only to when you buy a home. And I think that's important to have that information. That's why we included that in the education code last year. We included all that information. What is your likelihood of employability? What is your 4 and 6 year graduation rates? And schools that accept state money are now required to be transparent with this information, because as a parent, these are the things that I would like to see, because I think that if you give people the right information, I'm absolutely confident in their ability to make the right decisions. And I think that that's important, and it's an important component of that discussion. Me personally, I love history, and I know that we've talked about it on other radio interviews and podcasts as well. And the truth is, though, I knew that that wasn't necessarily the best career path for me. I loved archaeology. I loved history. I loved just learning about a variety of topics. But at the end of the day, I chose a career path that had a lot of opportunity that could then get me to my end goal, which was law school.
As you mentioned, there's a lot of money and an increasing amount of money year after year that goes from the state funded into the education system, in our higher education system specifically. Are there some things that can be looked at within that and redundancies as you mentioned, redundancies in both educating people twice on the same topic, but maybe several state schools that all teach the same thing? Are there some things that can be looked at to maybe better set our kids up and give better opportunities to the kids here in Pennsylvania so that they might be more successful?
Well, I think one of the things that we absolutely should do is focus our state resources to where we will get the biggest bang for our buck. And we should prioritize those high in-demand jobs. I believe, you know, if you talk to the folks who are involved in potentially trying to woo Amazon here, one of their concerns was our lack of an educational pipeline that could produce the number of technical and degree graduates for what they needed. So when you look at that, I think you first have to start with, where do we currently spend the money and what does that produce? And then two, and the Department of Labor already collects this information, what are the most in-demand jobs currently and what do they look like? And what do you need to do those jobs? You know, is it a certificate? Is it a national license? Is it an associate's degree, bachelor's degree, doctorate degree, whatever they are? We need to be more deliberative, I think, about that approach. And we need to be completely transparent with all of that information. So I know that Senator Ahmet has talked about this. I think it's a great idea. We've already done this with basic education funding, and that is have a commission that looks at where the money's going, what's being spent, what factors come into that. And that would look, I think, and this is certainly something the state system of higher education or PASHE's doing already. They're looking at their various schools saying, okay, what do we offer? What do we excel at? They're going through an introspective review. And I think as a state that funds a lot of these different areas, we should do the same and ask, what are the outputs? What are the goals? And are our expenditures lining up with those? It's going to be a much longer discussion and study probably than we have time here for today. But I do think that that's one that we absolutely have to have at the state level in order to prioritize that.
Representative Cutler, thanks for this time today. And make sure we'll continue this discussion and get into some regulation and tax climate discussion in the next podcast with House Majority Leader Brian Cutler.